I'm Caleb Brown, host of the Cato Daily Podcast. It is December, and I'm once again here to ask you to support this podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute by becoming a podcast sponsor. If you support Cato to the tune of $1,000, I'll give you a shout-out on the podcast. The only way to do this is to visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and make your contribution. Cato accepts no government money, and we depend on the generosity of our sponsors to help us advance the values of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and support the Cato Daily Podcast and the Cato Institute. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, December 17th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. The U.S. House has passed two articles of impeachment against President Trump. Cato's Gene Healy, author of the new Cato paper, Indispensable Remedy, walks us through the articles, why they were written the way they were, as a House vote looms this week.
Yeah, there have been a lot of talk in the last few weeks about cluttering up the articles with charges ranging from emoluments clause violations to obstruction of justice in the Mueller special counsel probe. And I guess in the end, the Democratic leadership decided that none of that really sparked joy, and they kept it minimalist. So what we've got is two articles of impeachment that focus on Ukrainegate and the president's response to the impeachment inquiry that Ukrainegate launched.
So, I assume there would be three, just based on history, that there would be three.
Well, there were only two in the most recent, in the Clinton impeachment. But what you've got is the first article is about the alleged shakedown attempt of the Ukrainian government, the withholding a state visit and military aid. Unless and until the Ukrainians announced an investigation into the man that was at that point Donald Trump's leading 2020 presidential rival, Joe Biden. Article 1 is about abuse of power, and it charges that President Trump abused the powers of his office, quote, for corrupt purposes in pursuit of personal political benefit. And one thing that's interesting is that despite some talk about bribery and extortion, the article really doesn't frame it in the language of the criminal law. And I think that all other things being equal, that was a smart way to go, because impeachment is not a criminal process. And when you try to shoehorn what we're talking about here, Trump's behavior and the surrounding the July 25th phone call, when you try to shoehorn that into a bunch of federal criminal statutes, you invite this hyper-technical legal debate, which is not where impeachment's supposed to be. Impeachment is designed, the core of impeachment is designed to get at not violations of federal criminal law or particular statutes, but misuse of the powers of the office in ways that can often be perfectly legal, but still corrupt.
So the second article, obstruction of Congress, this seems a lot more clear cut. There are numerous ways that the president has attempted to prevent Congress from, in a sense, performing oversight functions.
Well, it depends on who you ask, whether Article 1 of the impeachment or Article 2, obstruction of Congress, is more solidly grounded. They both have precedent in the Nixon case. Nixon, remember, you always have to point this out because someone will point out to you, as if you don't know, that Richard Nixon was not technically impeached because he quit before the hammer could drop. But in July 1974, the House Judiciary Committee voted out three articles of impeachment, the third of those articles was obstruction of Congress. And the notion is that in Nixon's case, partially, selectively, and duplicitously complying with congressional demands for information in an impeachment inquiry, he interposed the powers of the presidency against the lawful subpoenas of the House of Representatives and prevented the House from properly performing its constitutional obligation in an impeachment inquiry. And Article 2 of the articles that were just passed against President Trump actually quotes from Nixon Article 3 pretty heavily. Well, one thing you can say is that President Trump's resistance in this case is more flagrant than Richard Nixon's was. Nixon didn't, until the very end, stop complying entirely. Trump, from the beginning, has announced a categorical stonewall, a total blockade on anybody from the administration participating in the inquiry. Now, a couple of people have disobeyed that, EU Ambassador Sondland, but his policy is a total blockade, and that has prevented some key fact witnesses like Chief of Staff Mulvaney and John Bolton and some others from testifying in the House inquiry.
So Doug Collins, the top Republican on the Judiciary Committee, has said this is the first partisan impeachment in the history of the Republic.
Yeah, it's nonsense. The first partisan impeachment in the history of the Republic was the first impeachment. That's Senator William Blount in 1797. The fact is, from the very beginning, every high-profile impeachment has been a party-line impeachment with few defections. If you want to see a bipartisan impeachment, you'd have to go to, one of the many obscure federal judges that have been impeached. When the stakes are higher, particularly when you're talking about a presidential impeachment, you're always looking at a near party line vote. Even in the Nixon case, a majority of Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee voted against every article of impeachment. In fact, it was only Congressman Larry Hogan, the father of the current governor of Maryland, who voted for all three impeachment articles, the only Republican to vote for all three impeachment articles. So if your standard is going to be the impeachment needs to be bipartisan, that means you never impeach in any case, certainly any case involving the president. That said, it's bad that this is shaping up to be a more party line impeachment than even past impeachments. It's something that Alexander Hamilton warned about in the Federalist Papers, Federalist 65, that the danger was that the decision would be determined more by the comparative strength of the parties than by actual evidence of innocence or guilt. And that definitely looks to be how it's playing out here. But the fact that there's a party line vote doesn't tell you which side is being unreasonable.
So, and we'll talk again about what is likely to occur in the U.S. Senate once a trial commences. But what do you make of the idea that people like Lindsey Graham have said that they're not even really pretending to be impartial jurors or impartial judges of this case that would come before the Senate?
Well, there's a sense in which that's nothing new. For example, the claim about Majority Leader McConnell coordinating with the president's defense counsel, something very similar happened in our last impeachment with the Democratic leadership working with Bill Clinton's lawyers. So that's, you're not, if this proceeded like an actual criminal trial, you could disqualify everyone in the Senate from hearing the case. That's not new. On the other hand, Lindsey Graham flat out announcing that he's not going to be impartial is a flagrant violation of the oath that he's supposed to take at the beginning of this trial. So, again, not entirely unprecedented, but worse.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute and author of the Cato paper, Indispensable Remedy, The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. You too can become a Cato podcast sponsor. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor to make a gift today. And thank you.